Welcome to Foreman Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy, we're in that toughest time of the year, right?
I know. It's yeah, the trees are starting to bud.
We had our lovely producer pointed out to us that we're complaining about lack of ingredients we want to cook.
Mm-hmm.
And she points out, oh, well, it's St. Patrick's Day coming up.
Which is...
And she's very helpful in many fronts, but
yeah,
I reminded her Guinness was not an ingredient. I mean, maybe it's an ingredient to certain evenings, yes, in certain situations. It's an ingredient in much singing, I guess.
Yeah, I put Guinness in my artisanal cheese and Yukon gold potato soup, which actually is an excellent ingredient in that soup and kind of sets it off beautifully. But other than that, I can't think of a whole lot of times that I would cook with Guinness.
Well, yep. The other thing that's kind of
tough is... It's not like an onion.
All winter, you're trying to... You're like, oh, it's gray, it's cold, it's dark, it's wet. It's snowing. I have a fire. You know, you want warming things. You want rich things. You want heavy things. And wait a minute. My pants are tight. You know, we're in a different place
what
now.
What happened? Yeah.
But March is always a funny.
Well, and now we have to think about putting on bathing suits. And that, I mean, that gets serious. You have to start thinking about that.
I think about that every day. Cindy.
It's horrible.
I think about
it's a horrible thing. Yes.
That being said.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are in that moment of the year. What are the ingredients that are exciting? We can just kind of trade off. Like, what's exciting, do you think, right now to cook?
I'm so into root vegetables right now. And the natural sugar content of things like parsnips and celeriac and carrots, it's my love right now. And it's nice because when we roast them, we roast them to the point where they're still a little bit al dente, so they're still crunchy. And I don't know, I'm particularly in love with celeriac. And I think when I go in today, I'm going to make soup with celeriac because I've never done that. We've made puree.
You've never made celery root soup?
I know. Isn't that weird?
That is weird.
I was thinking, gosh, there are very few things I haven't made soup out of, and that is one of them. Certainly, we make a beautiful vegan tomato carrot soup that I'm in love with. I mean, it's just so good, and it's hard to believe.
That's
it
funny.
Has no fat, you know, nothing unhealthy in it. Celery root is...
To the restaurants, we've made bunches of celery root.
Yeah, I
Velouté in one.
Nope,
and
never.
And soup in the other. And
you know, I can tell you how I would do that. I know exactly how I would make it.
Go for it.
You know, it's going to be all about the celery root. So the funny thing about celery root is it looks sort of scary on the outside. It looks like something from another, you know, like 1,000 years ago. It's rooty and
it's funny. Pull it, I mean, you pull a whole celery stalk, you know, the whole, that's when you get a celery bunch.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's attached to. And the bigger the bunch of celery, the bigger and more gnarly that root is.
And they can be very big. And I kind of tend to like them when they're a little bit smaller. I would prefer to have a smaller one, but they're still a large piece of vegetable. And so they've got those roots on them, and they're, you know, they need to be washed really, really, really well. So
they look like they have beards on them, you know?
Yeah, they're super fun looking. I mean, I would show if I had kids, I would show it to them because I think it looks like something out of a storybook. But you want to wash it well, and this is when you bring out your vegetable brush because, yes, you're going to peel it, but I believe in cleaning something thoroughly before ever handling it, before ever putting it on a cutting board. And do think about that before you put it on your cutting board because then you're going to have to sanitize your cutting board and your knife before you work on it. And believe it or not, I tell every one of my cooks this all the time. Not that they need to be told, but I believe people need reminders. Anyway, so clean it well, brush it if you will, and then rinse it really well. And then you're going to peel it because none of that outside is desirable. So just use a paring knife or a chef's knife, whichever, depending on how big the celery root is, and cut the outside off, and you can discard that. And then cut it into pieces that are pretty small, you know, maybe inch by inch, something like that. You don't want gigantic pieces, and at the same time, you don't have to cut it into a small dice either. And you are pureeing it, so you don't have to worry about uniformity except for the fact that you're cooking it. And so that's where uniformity comes
into. You want it to be cooked evenly.
Right, right. So I would saute onions and shallots in butter. Develop no color whatsoever just until they're translucent and add the celery root. And this is where you make a decision. Am I going to make a vegetable stock soup or am I going to make a something with meat in it? And I would use a light chicken stock, one that probably isn't brown necessarily, or you could use a brown chicken stock, but just know it's richer and will add more flavor. So you could go either way. And I would cook the celery root until it was tender. And then the next decision is, am I adding cream to this or not? And I would add cream to it, but you don't have to. I'm sure it would be excellent without it. Salt, pepper, and then I don't see the need for any other type of, you know, spice or anything else, quite frankly. I would celebrate the celery root. And then I would add cream a little bit and then puree it and strain it. And I'm pretty sure you're going to have an absolutely delicious soup that tastes exactly like celery root. So, you know, if you like the flavor of celery.
Garnish?
I love the idea of like a chive creme fraiche or introducing lime, a lime creme fraiche. I mean, creme fraiche already has a level of acidity, but a little bit of fresh lime juice in there would brighten the soup. So I think really that's what I would do. You know, I might have a little bit of something crispy on the side. What would be fun if you don't mind frying at home, or you could even, you could immerse it in a small amount of fat in a small pot. But to have celery root chips would be fun, you know, just have that same flavor. You know, normally we like to think of something in contrast, or you could do, or
yeah, it's funny. The thing that comes to mind to me is something a little bit spicy.
Yeah, like what? You know? Like what?
I mean, just a little Calabrian chili oil, or
that would be great. Yeah,
you know, something along those lines, or a little pickled pieces of you know, Anaheim chilies, or something with a little pop to it.
Yeah, the soup's
because the celery has such a fresh, cool flavor.
Yeah, but it's
going to
be delicate. So if you had a lot of spice, you're going to
a little bit
would be fun. I also, for some reason, shrimp immediately come to my mind, and I could definitely see serving this with, you know, fried shrimp, or you know, crispy shrimp, or sautéed shrimp and butter with garlic or something like that. You know, maybe have the two things together. I could see it with scallops. Oh my God, it would be so good with pan roasted sea scallops. You could make this and turn it into a sauce
for scallops.
For sure, it would be delicious with scallops. Yeah. Actually, I might make that tonight. So, yeah, I mean, I love celery root. So that's, root vegetables are definitely, you know, on my mind for sure. And we can get, you know, really beautiful product right now.
Yeah, it's funny, the thing I always look for, I'm waiting for asparagus, you know, like, and every year, every chef has like, when is the asparagus farmer going to have, like, from somewhere between April 20th, how many times have I told you this? April 20th and April 25th, they're going to have enough asparagus that we can start with it.
Right.
They may have a little bit a week before, but not enough, and it's not what you want yet. But from there, for about 5 weeks, maybe six if we're really lucky, you'll have it. But until then, it's not. But right now, we've just started to get white asparagus.
Yeah.
From producers, and I love white asparagus, and I love playing with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a totally different flavor.
It does. It really does.
It's almost like nutty. It's almost nutty. Yeah, it's almost nutty.
It is. You
can blanch it and treat it like asparagus, and just give it like a very pretty beurre blanc with a fine herb, and you know, and that's fine.
Oh yeah, I serve it every year. My purveyor's already offered it to me, but the price on that is so insane, and especially with pricing now, oof, it's ugly. I mean, the first batch I declined because it's just too expensive. But it is a beautiful product. Can you explain why the pieces are so large when we get the white asparagus?
It depends on what kind you get. I mean, that's you're talking about the white stuff from the Lond.
Yes.
You know, it's the little pencils. I kind of get a kick out of the little pencils.
Well, yeah, the stuff we get in the United States is absolutely accessible. Yeah. I thought you were talking about the European pieces.
No, both, but honestly, you know me, I'm a peasant at heart, so it's kind of food-wise.
Sure.
So grilling it changes and becomes even more nutty.
Right.
So I was playing around with Marcona almonds at home, roasting them like slowly. And then cooling them in neutral oil, canola oil. And that almost takes on, like, and if you crush it, like in a food processor a little bit, you get this almost like almond oil. And making an emulsified vinaigrette with that and a little bit of mustard.
Yeah, nice.
And a little bit of white wine vinegar.
Yeah, I like that.
And that with the warm grilled asparagus with that like roasted almond vinaigrette.
Yeah.
And just a little bit of shallot in there.
I miss that restaurant with that wood-fired grill a lot. I mean, the wood-fired grill makes such a difference.
I have a Japanese grill, a round Japanese grill outside on my porch.
Oh, okay. All right. That's nice. It's a little guy.
Yeah.
That you can just easily
and put
fire up
a mix of like charcoal and small wood in there.
Nice.
And get really good flavor. And
yeah.
Yeah. Made a big stack of those for the girls. Just they got such a kick out of it.
It's funny. I always think of firing up the grill as such a commitment. With wood, I mean. Yeah. Not obviously not a gas-fired one, but yeah. And so that's good that you have that set up. I like that. That's a good idea.
It has a nice top, so like in the wintertime you can use it, and you close it, and it's, you know, it's a really kind of like a little oven.
Yeah, I just got my first fire pit for the farm, and because we're going to have a company party there and pretty soon, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I've always wanted a fire pit. But then that made me think, okay, now I need to get a grill over here, because, and maybe I'll just get a small one like that. That's a good idea, yeah. Because I have a gas-fired one, but I'd like to have... I also have an old horse trough that we've talked about turning into a wood-burning grill, would be fun.
This one also, I mean, you could, I've put pizza in there as well.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
Because it's like an oven.
Okay.
You know, that when you put the top on, if you work it the right way.
Oh, that's fun.
You know, so if you want to get really crispy stuff, you know.
Yeah, that reminds me of Bert. I love the fact that Bert Bassignani, one of the local winemakers, lives down the road from me. And I don't know when he opens up. I assume it's the spring, but spring, summer, and fall. He has, you know, you
it's
can go there.
Fun.
Oh, my gosh, it's so
it's
fun.
Pretty fun on the weekends.
Oh, my gosh. I highly suggest going Bassignani Vineyard. And, yeah, and he's Italian. And
Bertello Bassignani.
They have a home in Italy. They're there right now. Well, I shouldn't say that. Maybe they're not. But anyway, so.
They're often there this time of year.
Yeah, and he has had that wood-burning grill for his pizza oven for a long time, and I'm just like, oh, it is so good. I love going there.
The other thing with the white asparagus that I've done is, you know, the pasta-shaped trofie.
Mm-hmm.
It's
I love that shape.
Both the Ligurians claim it and the Sicilians claim it.
That's neat.
but it's the same thing, and I've done a version of, you know, the almonds and the white asparagus. And really good basil, you know, almost making like a pesto genovese, but not as much garlic, because you can't.
Yeah,
there's too much for the asparagus.
Sure,
but just a lighter version of that, with the trofie and the little slivers of white asparagus
and
almonds.
And you know, we're still getting.
And the last thing that goes in there is a little bit of flaked branzino.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
And
that's
then you
fun.
Put a little bit of garlic breadcrumb on top of that.
That's fun.
That's
God. I love bronzino.
Did that for the girls. Wanted they always want to make fish. And they always want to make pasta. So they're like, Dad, can you make fish pasta? It's like, sure.
Aw.
Yeah.
Nice.
So
you remember the almond sauce from, you know, the Spanish restaurant?
Yeah. I'm sorry. You're talking about the Romesco.
Yeah. That reminds me of what you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, but there's not smoked paprika in that.
Oh, okay. Okay.
That sauce, that wants meat because of that smoked paprika. It's a very strong element in that.
I love that so much. That was so good. I'll never forget the first time I tried that sauce.
Yeah. It was a fun one.
Brilliant.
The tomato, the almonds, the garlic.
Garlic.
And the smoked paprika.
Yeah.
That's the real strength of it.
Brilliant. It's a good, it is great for a piece of meat.
Yeah. Sort of wants. It wants
beef. Well, white asparagus, yeah. At least we can get it, and that's exciting.
It's actually really good for goat, too.
Oh,
lamb,
yeah.
Not so much. Lamb, not so much, but
well,
goat,
I can see
it
on chicken, too, but it might be a little strong. So with the almond, particularly that almond pesto, because I've heard you talk about that before, and that just sounds so good. What, you know, if you were to do that with whatever meat or whatever, or a piece of fish like that, what
the
what
sauce?
Wine? What wine are you?
I mean, lots of things. I mean, Tempranillo, the grape. Ribera del Duero, that's sort of more powerful version of Tempranillo, from one of the bigger producers, and the Ribera del Duero in Spain. That's in a heartbeat. You can also there are certain depends upon the cut a little bit too. Like if it's a fatty cut, you want more tannin, you want more power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's a leaner cut, you could even do something that's garnacha. You know, like from there's a small appellation in Spain.
Like venison or something?
Canagena. Yeah.
Like if you did venison, would that be good or no? Or is it not big enough for venison?
For venison, what would I say? You could go to Galicia and do, you can go to Galicia and do Bierto or Ribeiro, R-I-B-E-I-R-O, something up there, like a not as high alcohol, not quite as high tannin, but very intense. That's a nice venison match. Maybe not as much with that sauce, but just with venison in general. That's like a sneaky worthwhile.
What about the fish? Red. The fish pasta that you did for the girls.
Ooh, well, I mean that,
you know, for that, you. That's a, obviously.
That's a, yeah, I mean that's. Well, that.
Yeah. Well, you can't either.
I do let them taste.
Well, for guests, for your guests. Oh, all right.
Well,
oh, you can a little.
Yeah, I can.
All right, good.
Yeah, yeah. I can have that. Pigato, the grape from Liguria. It's a different cultivar of Vermentino.
Okay, I was gonna say I've never heard of that.
Also yes. Vermentino, but okay. Or the grape the French call Rolle, R-O-L-L-E. It's the
okay.
same thing.
All right.
Which is a different cultivar. But you see, yeah, it's that like bright, nutty, firm, clean mm-hmm. thing that it wants the a little bit of oily fish. It wants the bitterness of the almonds, and it shows up like fruity and beautiful with that.
That's cool.
And not like sweet fruity, but like fresh, you know, it's charming.
It just shows you how much food needs wine and wine needs food.
Yeah, well, it's music just, and dancing.
Yep, exactly.
There are plenty of dances you could do, Cynthia Wolfe.
There are.
That without music, that people would think that you were crazy.
I don't think they would think
and
that.
And I want them to think about that as we head towards the next segment here on Formula Wolfe on Food and Wine on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy, we're in the dearth of the year. March is always that way. What a charming term, right?
Well, that sounds so depressing.
Yeah, that's why.
Dark. Yeah.
So, that being said, mm-hmm. let's work on that
let's
ingredient
list. Let's be
happy.
List. Let's be happy.
Well, no, what are the things we're excited to
let's
cook?
Let's talk about happiness, yes. So,
oh, for God's sake.
Yes, sunshine and flowers. Like... My daffodils are coming up, which are amazing. And those little white flowers, they're so pretty. Everywhere on the farm.
And snowbells?
Snowbells.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Pretty. Well, we were just talking about, I mentioned venison with the romesco sauce we were talking about. And venison is definitely on my mind because...
Because there are hundreds of deer on your property.
There are hundreds of deer on my property. And not that I would ever, you know. But they're there to enjoy their lives, not that. But I can buy venison that someone else raised, thankfully. And, I'm just very much into venison right now. We were talking about, you know, the wine being with something that's lean like that. And how do you mm-hmm. think about that pairing? And I think that the strength and flavor of venison is so profound that it just leans so positively towards all the food that I like this time of the year, whether it is the root vegetables or roasted beets, another root vegetable, or potatoes, or, you know, all of these things that we eat a lot of and enjoy. And one of the other things is I got in Kalsatz the other day, which
Kalsatz,
which I have not seen in years because obviously I don't. You know,
yeah, we used to do mountains of them.
Yeah, yes, and
well, that you need romesco sauce for that.
Yeah, exactly. So we
venison with calzots is pretty great course.
Yeah, so that's I'm hoping I can get
also
more of them.
Honestly, rabbit.
Okay, so well, let's talk about what they
but
are.
You have venison on mine. So.
Yeah, most people won't know what they are unless you're Spanish or from Spain. So they look like huge green onions, and they are typical to Catalonia, right? Mm-hmm. And it's very important in the cooking there. And the romesco sauce with that is one of the more dreamy things I've ever eaten. And so I was serving them. Actually, we were actually using them as a garnish because they were so unbelievably delicious just with good olive oil and salt and pepper on them mm-hmm. and grilled. We were frying the green tops. We were julienning long, really fine julienne long pieces and frying them in peanut oil. Oh, my God. Those were so good just with a little salt on them. And then the white part, thin, long bias. Because we do small portions, you know, and so having, I don't need a lot on there, and you know it has a lot of flavor, so you don't want to blow out everything, but oh my gosh, I put them on the magre with a porcini risotto. So good.
You want to be very popular?
Yes.
Family meal, make French fries, and toss the fried calzot tops.
Oh. Well, venison and calzots would be a lot of fun, and I'm sure there's a lot of there's like a million things we could do with it. I have never served truffles with venison. I will admit that, and I don't really like the idea of it, quite frankly. And I think it must be the you know, quite frankly, the blood level in the meat.
It's the blood.
It's just too irony. It's the flavor. Yeah, it's too irony for the, for a truffle.
It'll knock them out.
Right. So I'm also very much into Cibollini onions.
A mushroom that's less mineral, more woodsy,
works. Right, right.
You know, like black trumpets in a heartbeat.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is we got chanterelles in the other day, which I was surprised by, and they were absolutely gorgeous, and they're the kind I like. They were, you know, tight little tiny caps and, you know, little quirky-looking things, and oh, my gosh, they were good. And that is actually very, very good with venison. And then, you know, you need something like creamy polenta. You need some sort of fatty, wonderful, you know, whether it's, you know, great fingerling potato. Well, and that's the other root vegetable we're working with. We're doing a lot with we had local fingerlings until just this past week, which was great.
Honestly, it makes me want faro.
Oh, right.
Faro.
Oh,
with,
sure.
Faro verde with venison.
Gosh, yeah. Just
the texture, you know, like that little like, you know, almost, I don't know, ancient grain kind of bite to it.
Sure, absolutely. You know, we get our polenta stone ground for us, so it's really a great product. Has a lot of flavor. It's from an heirloom variety corn that was grown in the South, so it's a brilliant thing and very simple, but can be absolutely delicious. And with the venison, you could also do something like using some form of pork product to lean fat to the plate. So maybe you're doing something so simple as putting a thin slice of Iberico ham or jamón Iberico or a piece of prosciutto on the plate with it, or going in another direction, which is really having a piece of pork belly on the plate or having a pork product like andouille sausage. We're getting a really beautiful, very spicy, high paprika level, which is not spicy, but there's some serious cayenne in this this andouille sausage that is just really, really good. And it also has an acid level that's just perfect. So it's just this, like, really beautifully pork-flavored andouille sausage with these other levels of intensity that are come together really perfectly. Something like that, grilled, sliced on a bias with a piece of venison, and then again, if like you had the potato puree on there, man, those things would be so great together. Well, I'm always striving for the perfect bite of food on the plate.
Then make a venison club sandwich with some of the andouille sausage and...
Yeah, right?
Yeah, why not?
No, por qué no? That's what
there's
I say.
There's your bite.
Sounds good. What's your other thing you're thinking about?
I mean, like, that's funny. I said faro because faro is my brain.
Okay.
You know, so the
so what
texture.
What is it? Let's talk about what it is.
It's an older form of wheat, basically. Mm-hmm. It's one of a number of old grains. Mm-hmm. You see it especially in the north in Italy, and as I spend a lot of time on the food of the north of Italy, that's, you see it up in Valtellina. You see, like, places where wheat does not grow that easily, it still is grown.
Mm-hmm. What color is it?
Kind of a gray-green.
I was wondering if it was green. I've never actually seen
it. When you cook it becomes less green.
Okay.
But they'll call it a farro verde.
Mm-hmm. Very good. All right.
And but I like that texture.
So how do you cook it? Do you cook it like, is it stirred?
Almost like risotto.
I was going to say, is it like risotto?
Almost like risotto.
Okay,
you know, or if like like bulgur wheat, almost the same kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Does it give off starch or no?
Not particularly.
No, okay.
Not particularly.
So it's not going to be creamy. It's going to
I like that.
Absolutely.
Especially if it is for something that's kind of fatty, mm-hmm. or if it is for something with a real sauce, or like a lot of Italian food, a lot of things have like little condimento, you know, that there's a something that, you know, there's like a punchy accent.
Sets everything
or
off.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, it might just be something as simple as a drizzle of ancient balsamico or, you know, that kind of thing.
That'll definitely set it off.
Or a little fonduta, you know, like, talking about like that grill that I have, mm-hmm. taking a rabbit, you know, splaying it out slowly putting on the slow embers.
Right.
You know, roasting it, smoking it kind of at the same time, pulling it all apart. And then tossing that with the farro and hitting with a little fonduta doing that as like as a primo, you know.
Oh, I could eat that right now.
Make the fonduta with a cheese a little stronger, a Castelmagno or something like that. Mm. Since we're talking about it, like Trentino is a place where you see this.
Okay.
That narrow valley in the Dolomites where
grain
does
Dolomites.
Not grow that long, and farro has a short growing season. So, you know, you'll see it. That offset texture, I've been really enjoying that. You know, that kind of thing. like lentils. It's funny, in the winter we yeah. always do.
I love beans.
People want to have, they love when we do burrata and tomatoes. But we get great tomatoes a lot of the year. We get tomato, those are quote unquote secret Amish tomatoes from a particular source. Mm-hmm. You know, like from like tax day on. It's crazy.
Yeah, which is nice.
And then when you get into real tomato season, we get so many different varieties from different farmers in Maryland, mm-hmm. and it's great. Mm-hmm. But by the time you get to, you know, like the school year is in full swing, tomatoes are not the same. Done. Once in a while, first mm-hmm. week of October, if you have Indian summer, you have something that's worthwhile. But then the acids get too high and the sugars are not there. And you're done. So then you're like, what am I going to put with it? Because they still want burrata and something. And this winter, we came across with black beluga lentils. Mm-hmm. And that was...
they're beautiful.
Yeah, and they
I
are.
I love them.
They look beautiful, but the texture with the burrata... It's really, literally, you're talking about the perfect bite. Texture is a big piece of that. Mm-hmm. And everything, you know, something creamy with something that has that little edge to it, that mm-hmm. little snap, cook it exactly al dente, mm-hmm. you know, where it's done but has its texture intact.
Cooked in what? Chicken broth or what?
Cooked in chicken broth, mushroom broth, mm-hmm. You know, that.
I like the idea of the mushroom broth.
The, you know, but that's what always. Nice. I mean, it's funny.
I love black beluga lentils. Mm.
Trying to make sure we do things that are thoughtful so things are easily adapted to vegetarian needs.
Yeah.
Or even
exactly.
vegan needs.
Of course.
You know, that's something
yeah.
that.
Yeah, which is nice. When you have something like that, you might as well make it vegan.
Well, and you're showing off the ingredients.
It's good.
Real flavor. That's, yeah. you know, it's like with the farro. A lot of times it's not chicken stock. And once in a while, we'll go ahead and cook it with, you know, like chicken and pig's feet and. Mm-hmm. You know, honestly, we'll make chicken stock mostly with chicken feet and throw a pig's foot in there, and
yeah,
you know, that is amazing. But
yeah,
it's
exactly.
not the same. Not, that's not it. It invades the flavor of the mm-hmm. of the item, you know. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah, those things with texture like that, and farro is definitely one of them. Different kinds of beans and lentils can be another one. Mm-hmm. You know, different kinds of rice can be that way.
Well, you know, you were talking about tomatoes. We can obviously get green tomatoes, which are fine any time of the year. And last summer we were getting fresh buffalo milk mozzarella from Campania. And it's just such an incredible product. It's literally flown here and we get it. And it was offered to me the other day and I'm like, oh, well, I haven't served it since last summer with the tomatoes, with the heirlooms. And so I thought, well, why not do it with just fried green tomatoes? And we do get the little Campari on the vine, you know, tomatoes, and they make a good relish. They really do. And so I make a relish with saffron and lime and Tabasco and the chopped up little tomatoes and extra virgin. Oof, I love that relish. And with the green tomatoes is excellent. And then the mozzarella just is the greatest foil. I mean, and we put arugula on there. And that is a stack. You know, you were talking about sandwiches earlier.
Yeah. Well, you know, I love a sandwich, so...
This is seriously good. I mean, I put it on the menu probably, a week ago, and I think the first night we sold like 40 of them. It literally just, people just love fresh buffalo milk mozzarella. It's like burrata. It's, you know, just people just love these things, which is understandable. It's just so silky and, you know, lovely and beautiful and great flavor.
But you have
flavor.
To set it off the right way or it gets boring.
It needs help. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. yeah.
But it's a good foil for other things.
Yeah, that's this last, finally... We've preserved tomatoes in so many different ways, and we've made so much sauce before, but finally this last year we started just preserving whole summer tomatoes, you know.
Yeah, good.
Just like give them a very light roast, concentrate the flavor, and preserve them in olive oil, and now we have them to
play
with.
That's nice to have.
Well, we're just getting towards the latter half of them, mm-hmm. hoping that the Amish stuff kicks in here in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, we'll see what the season is like.
Yeah.
Be curious to see.
Yeah.
It was a little different last year, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah,
for sure. Well, and everything's, you know, we're in bud break. I cannot believe it. I mean, it's crazy to see some of the flowers already blooming on the trees. And we have cherry blossoms over in the circle. So, you know, it's going to be an interesting season.
That's downtown. What I'm curious about, I've just started talking with some of the farmers we work with. Mm-hmm. Like that, I always worry about spring for the farmers in the orchards.
Of course. Well, I can tell you, I have 6 fruit trees that I planted last year. It was one of the first things I planted, and they are dormant. They are not doing a thing right now.
Yeah, and that's good.
On my farm, yeah. No, it needs
to
be
the later they break, the safer it is.
Sure, of course. Yeah, because we had a horrible freeze last year, so.
We've had, we've had 4 out of 5 years we haven't had apricots from the one fellow we get them from in Pennsylvania because of the...
Yeah, bad weather.
Yeah.
Yeah, so let's hope we don't have any of that and it doesn't affect their...
So what's next on your list?
Well, I kind of want to get back to the whole calçot, onion, shallot, thing because, I mean, I'm also doing sort of a butter poached mixture of all those things and a little bit of celery in there for fish right now, which is really, really, really
like a
simple.
Puree or?
No, just everything chopped very, very fine. And just everything's cooked separately. So the garlic butter poached, the cipollinis are roasted in the oven. The onions sautéed in their own butter with salt and pepper. Add the celery at the end of the cooking process. Mm-hmm. So you have the roasted shallots, roasted cipollinis, butter poached garlic, gently sautéed onion. Add celery to the end. And what I've done is taken a little bit of breadcrumb and added it to it at the end and added a tiny bit of stock and not making it into a stuffing, but making it all come together and not losing any of the fat from any of the processes. And it's just so good with a piece of beef or a piece of fish. So it's just a lot of fun. So it's just one of those things that all of those things are available. And if you use salt and pepper, you don't need anything else. You know, if you just take care of each one of those ingredients, it's a little bit like making ratatouille. When I make ratatouille, I cook all the ingredients separately and then start to combine them near the end. And you take care of each one of those products, you can make something that's really quite good. So that's that. That was the other thing I was thinking about because the calçots brought all that to mind too.
Yeah, it's funny. Now, if you were in the Veneto, you would take all of that. And at the end, you would cook it all together and you would add a little vinegar.
Nice.
And maybe a little bit of honey.
Mm-hmm.
And some black pepper, and then cook it into goo almost. And that's there, like that kind of thing is a condimento, that because of the vinegar and enough salt, you could have it preserved.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, that would be good with foie gras. That immediately comes to mind for me for foie gras, or like confit, if you had confit, and to have that with it.
Imagine a piece of like grilled pork belly.
Good Lord. Oh, I'm,
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And a nice, you know, croissant, like big fat piece of, you know, crunchy toast with that spread on it.
That would be so good. Well, and to tie into the, we started to also talk a little bit about beans. I mean, that's been my whole thing all winter. Anytime I'm entertaining at the farm, I my friends are probably like, is she going to make beans again? Well, the last time I made beans, I also bought two tiny pieces of Wagyu from one of our local grocery that actually has it. And that was a big bite, right? It was money-wise, obviously. Yeah, but the main meal was all day long. I found oxtails and I made oxtail broth, which I don't think I've ever done. I really don't recall ever working with oxtails before. Oh my gosh. That was one of the most delicious bean broths I've ever made. And I did put some of that at the end. I put a tiny bit of that really good andouille sausage that I was talking about, but I didn't want there to be too much of that in there because that oxtail broth was absolutely gorgeous. And I had these gigantic lima beans that kind of look like the old rattlesnake beans that I used to buy. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, they were so good. And of course, they had a long cook time and they just sat in there and absorbed all that beautiful oxtail broth. And I didn't put much, I couldn't find my saffron. I didn't feel like going to get the saffron from somewhere else. So I ended up just, you know, it was really onion, celery, carrot. I had black peppercorns in that house and I had the oxtails, browned them. And I pulled every bit of that meat off when it was done, and man, it was good. Really good. So I strongly suggest playing around with that.
Sounds great. It's good to be your friend.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Well, when we come back on Formidable from Food and Wine, it's a few more of the ingredients we're like fighting to work with in this time of year we're waiting for spring on WYPR. Welcome back to Foreman Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy and I are talking about, it's that tough time of year where you're like, you're tired of making winter food and you want spring ingredients. You want to feel the sun, you want to see these things growing, you want to find them and bring them into your kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
So at this toughest moment, what else do you want to cook? What else are you excited about?
We recently got in sturgeon and we're getting some different.
We used to get a lot of sturgeon back in the day.
I love sturgeon.
You have to treat it almost like a piece of veal.
Yeah, it's
firm.
It kind of looks like a piece of veal in a way. It's sort of the same color as veal. Oh my gosh, it's just so good. It does have a lot of bones in it, so it's not the easiest fish to work with for someone that's not you know, used to cutting a lot of fish up and butchering it or whatever. But it really has such a great flavor. So I think right now, you know, what is available to us is beautiful cold water fish and cold water seafood. So, you know, lobsters are great right now because they're in their hard shells and, you know, they're full, they're filled out. They are expensive. Actually, lobsters right now are the most expensive I have ever seen them in my life. You know, the sturgeon, you know, it lends itself towards anything like a prep, anything like you would use for tuna or any of the oily fishes that have a lot of flavor. And we have Gordal olives, and really, they're just, it's just big, fat, rich, green olive that is one of the best olives I've ever tasted in my whole life. They make the great relish. I was serving them with magre and a sort of traditional red wine sauce for magre, because of their acid level and the fact that they're packed, what they're packed in and everything, the process of making an olive, it just lends itself to anything with a high fat content. So that fish is perfect. And, you know, you can do something so simple as just, you know, cut them in half, hit them with a little olive oil, maybe have a little bit of basil or chives, a tiny bit of finely chopped shallot, and, you know, a little pepper, and just, you know, make a quick little relish. I mean, that's so easy to do for dinner at home. And, you know, you can pan roast the sturgeon, or if you've got the grill out back and you feel like turning it on. Obviously, it's very, very good grilled. I do like it closer to medium rare in the cooking process. You don't want to cook it well done, certainly, I don't think. But you can. I mean, if that's the way you like to eat your fish, you can. But it is a fish you can cook to medium rare.
Well, I think a sturgeon, you were talking about those chanterelles that you just got. That's, when I think of sturgeon, I always want to go very classically French. I always want potato. I want to treat it like a piece of veal. I want a potato puree for that. You know, I want a meat stock reduction sauce. And, you know, with the...
It can stand up to it. That's
the thing. With the chanterelles, you know, finish it with some butter, give it some shine, and calm it down.
Yeah.
You know, and boom, I'm done with that.
Yeah.
Give me that and a nice baguette and, you know, really charming rosé champagne or a bottle of Burgundy, you know, maybe a Volnay, something not super tannic, but with good intensity. Maybe a bone Premier Cru.
Okay, nice.
L'Enfant Jésus or something like that.
And the other fish we've gotten in is pompano, which I kind of think of these a little bit like old-fashioned fish. You know, they're things that I remember eating when I was a kid in restaurants. Oof, if you can get pompano, oh my gosh, it is, it's tender, it's kind of sweet.
It's an oily
flavorful
fish with a ton of flavor.
Yeah, it's, I love pompano. And that, man, you, go ahead. You're on fire.
Well, no, I have, when I was 20 years old, cooking at the Union League in Philadelphia, and I put on a tasting menu, pompano provençal and papillote, right?
Yum.
All the provençal vegetables, you know, in wrapped in the paper with a pompano fillet.
That's such a fun one.
And good
cook.
Oil.
Yeah.
You know, and and people went nuts, and you know, the captains would cut it with the paper, cut the paper at the table, you know.
Love it.
Lay it out, lay all the vegetables out, and dress it with a little more oil, and
I wish we could do things like that.
Ooh, ooh. Mm-hmm. And people went nuts, and it just became, I was the first thing that I put on that my chef was like, I'm taking that.
Oh.
I was doing a little tasting menu every day for a 40-seat dining room, and he was like, no, that's going, I'm putting that on the menu.
All right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome,
you
chef.
You can't make that anymore.
Okay.
I was very proud of the fact that he, like, officially stole it from me.
All right.
So yeah, pompano, I have feelings about.
Well, if folks were listening to the earlier segment, the whole garlic shallot celery breadcrumb thing.
Ooh, perfect.
That's what I served with the pompano, and oh my gosh, it was, it was a treat.
That has flavor. It wants flavor.
Yeah, yeah. Pompano is, if you know, like I said, if you can find it, go get it. And you know, so right now, I'm going to do a lobster course, for a bar menu that we're doing. That I'm very excited about, sort of a decadent little bar menu. And you know, I rarely serve a whole lobster tail because we serve the lobster soup and we go through so much lobster that way that we use the scrap pieces or the not the tail pieces for our lobster ravioli that Everato makes. So it's really all utilized and that's a lot of lobster to go through. So, but I'm just determined to do a lobster tail. You know, I'm going to gently cook it in butter and cut it into little medallions and serve it with a caviar beurre blanc.
Sounds rugged.
That just makes me happy. And, you know, a little bit of fingerling potato puree on the plate. And I'm just like, yeah, that's just going to be, that is the definition of decadent to me. You know, caviar is a prized product. And, you know, to have the beautiful fingerling potato puree, you know, I think a lot of chefs in this country strive to do Robuchon's potatoes and no one will ever do the potatoes as well as he did. But we, a lot of us strive for it, and that is what I teach my cooks, and it is that crazy ratio of almost a pound of butter to a pound of potatoes, which is not easy to make. And, you know, it doesn't have to be a pound. You don't try it at home, but, you know, half a pound to a pound of potatoes is pretty reasonable.
You're making potato sauce.
No, I mean, that's the reality. Yeah, well, it's what it is it's, and I will, cannot tell you enough how good fingerling potatoes are made into puree. It's a lot of work because you're either
to peel those little suckers.
Yeah, to peel those guys after you've boiled them, but that process is worth the effort, especially if you're doing it at home and you're making it like for four people. Unlike us, we're making it for, you know, a night where we're serving 150 people. It can be a daunting process for us, but, you know, to make it at home, that's one of those things that, you know, you can do with love and care and just make it into a beautiful thing. And, you know, one of the big things about making that kind of potato puree is you really need to put your potatoes after you've cooked the fingerlings and taken the skin off. You put them through a ricer and then you put them in a bowl, in a double boiler situation. So you're in a big bowl over a pot with water, warm water in the bottom, and you emulsify, basically you're emulsifying in cold butter into those hot potatoes. And that is an extremely important part of the process. You will never be successful adding melted butter in large quantities to potato. Well, you will be successful, but it'll be a bit of a mess. It's not the idea. It's not the idea.
The idea is for it to almost all but emulsify.
It exactly. Yeah. Right. So if the butter is cold, then it won't separate into its different parts, which is fat, milk, solids, and water. And that way it will just melt into the potatoes. And you can add a tiny bit of cream and salt and black pepper. And that's like the most decadent thing in the world to me. Besides, well, there are a couple of others.
You like the decadent things.
Yep, I do. I also like really healthy things. I like all kinds of things, but I am good at cooking things that are decadent. There is no question. I've eaten a lot of great things in Europe, and I do try to emulate some of those chefs for sure.
I was thinking about the pompano. You sent you the queen of fried green tomatoes. Hmm. How about just a nice little
stack of green tomatoes?
Mm. Or, you know, talking about sandwiches, put one above and one below on a really nice relish.
Yeah, that's a happy situation. Green tomatoes have a lot of purpose. I mean, there's so many things you can do with them. And I would just tell you very simply, I used to do a full breading process on that. It used to be buttermilk, you know. Buttermilk, actually, flour and cornmeal.
Nope.
That's when you and I started working together. That was how I first made them in D.C. For a restaurant that we both opened together, where I was doing low country cooking. Not that many years later, I immediately just started doing simply cornmeal, cayenne pepper, and salt. And we don't even put the salt on until they come out of the fryer because the salt will leach the liquid out and ruin the batter.
Yeah.
Well, the light breading procedure. It's not a batter. But yeah, that's all it takes because the green tomato has enough moisture that the cornmeal will adhere to it. And, you know, that's the whole reason why you do a buttermilk or an egg wash or whatever is to get it to stick.
Yeah.
And it's not necessary with a green tomato. Well, that was fun, Tony. I kind of love talking about all of those things, and that was a fun exchange of information. You know, one of the things I think about when it comes to wine, you know, I'm heading to Europe this spring. And when I don't have you with me or someone that's really knowledgeable and has all those vintages in their head like you do, how do we, all the rest of us normal people that don't have all those things in our brain, help ourselves to understand vintages? Or is there a way to, you know, tap into it easily or what?
I mean, it certainly depends on circumstance. I mean, retail is always going to have what the latest thing is for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And in those situations, you either need to have a relationship with somebody at the retailer, or you need to be somewhat informed, especially if you're making significant purchases. The retail stores I'm involved in, we do a lot of tasting so that people know that mm-hmm. we try to be transparent about things, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, and I guess I should also ask you, why is knowing a vintage important, you know, for everyone?
Well, it was last summer just like the summer before, mm-hmm. or the one 5 years ago. Like, they're all a little bit different.
Because it's a farm product, yeah, and it's grown
out
in our environment that is not only normally constantly changing, but it's changing even more because of global warming.
Yeah, it's accelerating. Right. So, I mean, I'm going to take two different trips this year to taste overseas, and one of them is going to be to the southwest of England to taste sparkling wines.
What?
Because, yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Because we've had a couple of excellent things recently.
Yeah, I have heard you talk
about
that.
In the last couple of years.
Colin,
and
that's crazy.
I want to go see what the growers are doing. I know the soil. I know that geologically that the soil is very similar in certain areas.
To the Champagne region
of France.
To Champagne,
yeah.
Wow.
And so, climatically, it is becoming more similar to Champagne than it was. The distance from the sun, has not changed, but the effect of the sun is, you know, so that, I'm just curious
That's
to see exactly what the details are of what's happening in production, how it differs. As many times as I've been to Champagne and know what the growers do there,
yeah,
I'll be curious to see exactly what's happening there.
I'm curious, are the English winemakers, are they all people from England? Well, I mean, you probably don't know the answer
some,
to that, but
I
would be curious to know if some of them are from Champagne. You know, have people from Champagne moved to England to make wine? Would be interesting to know.
As long as the wine, they're supporting the right football clubs.
Oh.
You know, that's that.
You don't
especially
really care.
Mine, I really don't care where they're from.
So you're killing two birds with one stone,
exactly,
I see.
Right. No, No. There's no wine being grown up in... In a working class neighborhood in Liverpool, where my team is from.
Okay.
So,
all right, your team.
Hey, you know, we identify with what we identify with, you know. And honestly, the Baltimore Orioles and Everton Football Club, for me, they hit the exact same spots.
Okay, that's cool.
That's without getting into a lot of ridiculous history on a program that's about food and wine.
Okay.
In the end, vintages are the quality of the growing season, and they inform the characteristics of the wine that's in the bottle. And it's very quick tidbit. 2020 Bordeaux, fabulous vintage, great vintage, and a lot of it. If the retailer purchased it as futures, they purchased it at advantageous prices because of the pandemic and because of the exchange rate at that moment.
Hmm.
I mean, for example, we bought a ton of 2020s.
Okay. Yep.
For the restaurants and for retail because of that.
They're coming in
and
now.
And the vintage is tremendous.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to taste one of them. They're here.
So, I mean, that's you're looking at 82, 2009, and 2020, probably.
Oh, really? Those are okay.
As maybe the
2009,
strongest.
2020.
That being said, that's all we have time for.
All right.
So,
thank you.
If you want to listen to this program again, Cindy, or any one of our podcasts, go to the WIPR website. It's WIPR.org. Look for the Foreman Wolf page, and there's a whole menu of goodies there for you. Where we argue about all kinds of topics, trying to be pleasant. If you want to email, correspond with us, it's foremanwolf@wipr.org. To follow Chef Cindy Wolf on social media,
you can follow me on Instagram or Facebook as Chef Wolf.
My Instagram is The Real Tony Foreman. And thanks for listening.
Happy Sunday.